Welcome to Middle Grade Mavens, where two author mums discuss their favourite middle grade books, provide recommendations, and share insider industry tips for authors trying their hand at middle grade. Julie Ann Grasso is the author of the Frankie DuPont mystery series, cupcake enthusiast and part-time library book wrangler. Pamela Ukerman is a writer, dancer, and homeschooling mum who sometimes finds time for sleep. Both Julie and Pamela devour middle grade books, not only for research, but to share with their combined brood of four munchkins. Hi, Pamela, and welcome back to Middle Grade Mavens for our 64th episode.
Hi.
So, what's been happening?
Well, as we were just discussing, I just raced here from watching the block.
Right.
The latest obsession in our house. And, yeah, because we now in Melbourne, you know, we're getting to the light at the end of the tunnel in terms of COVID and being locked down, and spring's on the way, and there's a huge sense of hope in Melbourne. And with that comes, for us here, a bathroom renovation, which we're badly, badly in need of. The bathroom's literally crumbling every day. So watching the block kind of, yeah.
It's exciting.
It's that excitement and the inspiration going. But anyway, yeah, that's really all that's been happening, apart from lots and lots of reading. And yep. I'm very excited because we have some amazing books coming our way, lots of which were delayed because of the pandemic. So I'm like racing through them. And I've also been trying to find a new series for Joke Boy because he has the biggest book hangover from reading the whole How to Train Your Dragon series by Cressida Cowell.
Yes.
So his nothing will ever be as good as that, you know. Oh. Even Harry Potter's not as good as that. So,
wow.
Yeah, and we are reading the Wizards of Once series together. But he's actually read all of the ones that are out so far. So we're anticipating the fourth book, and I will be talking about that in an upcoming episode. And I will be talking about just how amazing Cressida Cowell's books are and why.
Yes.
So, yeah, I've ordered a couple of things to try out for him.
Good.
Fingers crossed he finds something that he will enjoy.
Yeah,
otherwise
it's
could be a disaster. His whole, book reading lifestyle over at the age of seven.
Yes.
But anyway, what about you, Julie?
Well, I have a literary confession to make. Are you ready for it?
Oh, dear.
I purchased and have begun reading Midnight Sun by Stephanie Myers. I know, oh. I know. Probably just lots of you listeners with this dazzling confession, but hear me out. Okay, I think, obviously, hopefully anyone who listens knows that I was not a reader as a child. I didn't read till my late teens. Anyway, so I'd been poached by a medical company. So I left the hospital quite a while ago now. And this medical company sent me all over the world to go to conferences. And I was in a lot of hotels and airports. And the curious thing about American airports is that they have bookshops that do book exchanges. So you buy the book and then you exchange it back at the next port of call kind of thing. So I must have purchased the first Twilight during one of those trips, and all the books were out. So I just kept going, just kept buying and exchanging, and I literally finished the series. But it was before I'd started to write, so I just kind of read it. You know, this is an interesting tale. I didn't really analyze it, and I thought, well, if Stephanie Myers can give it a go, why can't I? So, you know, I'm never going to pen a teen romance that sells billions, but I did feel compelled to see how she continued the story so many years later, because she basically is rewriting the first book, switching to Edward's point of view. Not, you know, if you don't even know who Edward is, then sorry, folks. So regardless of whether or not you're a fan, I'm reading this book with the most intense scrutiny to see how she's done it. And gosh, it's a deep first person point of view, which I think some people find mad. You find that a bit maddening, don't you? First person.
It's just too much of it.
This is 700 pages.
Yeah. But it's like the thing at the moment. It's like nobody knows how to write their person, you know, and I get tired of it too. Yeah. Not so much in one book, but just in so many books. Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go, airing my literary laundry within the first few minutes of the podcast. And in completely other useless lockdown news, Gigi and I are taking a day off remote learning on Monday because we're going to paint the toilet a lovely shade of birch forest, which I've painted on the wall, and it is very dark. It's going to be the brooding toilet of mystery. Anyway, I'll report back on that scintillating interlude next episode. Anyway, onto the books. Tell us.
Oh, yes.
What is the title of today's book?
Not the teen romance, but yeah, I know I haven't read Twilight, so, you know.
I knew you'd be a purist.
Oh, no. You know, I've read some interesting things in my time, and I have travelled a lot for work and picked up whatever I could at bookshops in airports, but Twilight was a bit after that.
yes.
Anyway, today I'm reviewing for the am I doing more than one book today? No, I'm not. Yes, I am.
Yes, you are.
Yes, I am. So today I'm reviewing The Silver Arrow by Lev Grossman.
Would you share the jacket blurb with us?
I will. Kate wasn't expecting much when she wrote to her wealthy estranged uncle to ask for a birthday present. Certainly she wasn't expecting a colossal steam train called the Silver Arrow to arrive on her doorstep. Despite parental misgivings, curiosity overwhelms Kate and her brother Tom, and they climb aboard, only for the train's engine to roar into life. Soon they reach a train station where an assortment of strange and beautiful creatures are waiting with tickets in their mouths, and Kate and Tom begin to understand that their job will be to see them safely home if they can. Now, I didn't write the publisher for this one, so you'll have to forgive me for that. Put it in the show notes.
Well, it'll be in the show notes.
Yes, but it is, I think it's this month, it's this year. It's a brand new book.
Well, I mean, I wish I had a wealthy, estranged uncle to write to for a magical train, but clearly that's not going to happen during this pandemic. What genre would you class this as?
Yes, it's a bit glittery. We'll say this magical realism. Yeah.
And what is the estimated word count?
It's around 40 to 50,000 words. I think it's not that long.
Cool. So tell us about it.
Yeah. So the author, Lev Grossman, now talking about going back to, you know, early days of reading, Lev Grossman wrote a series called The Magicians, which is now a TV show, I believe. And the first book in that series left a huge wake in my life more than 10 years ago. I think it was in 2009. I was traveling in the south of France and staying in this little medieval village, and we stayed in a medieval butcher's shop that had been converted into accommodation, and it still had some of the some of the hooks on the walls, and it was just gorgeous. But whenever I think of this place, I think of The Magicians, which was an absolutely powerful, adventurous, gut-wrenching, just amazing, amazing, amazing book. They do say it's Harry Potter for grown-ups, but very, very grown-up.
Right.
I actually couldn't bring myself to read. It was an amazing book. I loved it, but I couldn't bring myself to read the second one, and I do have it still. So when I saw this book had come out, I was intrigued to see that he'd written for children. I wanted to know what it was like. So on to the story.
Yes.
So on Kate's 11th birthday, her uncle gives her a train in her front garden, but not just a toy train, a life-sized magical train called the Silver Arrow. Kate yearns for adventure and for change, and she gets it when the Silver Arrow begins chugging away from their house with her brother Tom in tow. Kate learns that as conductors of the Silver Arrow, she and Tom now have a mission to complete, although they don't yet know what that is. But no mind, the train can tell them what they need to do, and yes, the train can talk in its own way. As they travel further away from home, they stop at strange stations, picking up and dropping off very polite talking animals, some of whom they befriend. With a luxurious sleeping carriage, a library, dining cars, and a candy car at their disposal, it all seems like a fun trip. But soon there are obstacles in their way and their journey takes a more serious tone. Kate is forced to step up to her responsibilities and learn more about the world around her, including the plight of the animals she ferries from station to station.
That's a really interesting premise, isn't it? Like,
Yeah. Yeah.
And what was your overall enjoyment?
Yeah, so when I started, I thought, okay, it sounds like quite a simple book. It's a simple story. And it sort of has an old classic feel to it with a modern message. And as the train journey progressed, it felt a little like a non-Christmas version of the Polar Express. And at times it felt overly moralistic, teaching the reader many lessons through the character of Kate and also lessons about the various animals she encounters. But I really got pulled into this adventure. It drew me along to this beautiful and important message, which was a call to arms for endangered animals around the world. And yeah, by the end of the book, I was really moved. I do think it was written with this sort of old classic feel in mind, and it's targeted in that way. And I'm actually thinking of using it as a read aloud for homeschool when we finish our current series.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
Because it's got so much to talk about. It's a simple story, simple plot, but it's got a lot to talk about. And it was just beautiful at the end.
Yeah. Oh, good luck. You'll have to tell us how the boys like it.
Yeah.
Who will love this book? What age would you recommend this for?
Yeah, it's actually a great all-rounder. I think it's perfect for children aged around 6 or 7 as a read aloud, and then, of course, for older children to read to themselves.
Great.
Yeah. Now, Julie, we are both doing 2 books today, aren't we?
No, I'm only doing 1.
Oh,
can you believe it?
What month is it now?
It's because I've been reading Midnight Sun.
Right. I don't know. So for listeners out there, I have a very special book coming up and a very special interview. So I've been reading as fast as I can to make space for this particular quite thick book. So
Stay tuned.
I have no idea. I have no idea what day, what week it is. So what's the title of your first book, Julie?
Yes. The Heart Song of Wonder Quinn by Kate Gordon, illustrated by Rachel Tribou. Published by University of Queensland Press in September 2020.
And the cover of this is just gorgeous.
Oh, it is. Yeah. Yep.
And could you share the jacket blurb with us?
Sure. Lonely orphan Wonder Quinn lives in the attic of Dyerleaf Hall with only a gloomy crow for company. Every year she hopes to make a true friend, and every year her heart breaks when she doesn't. But when a spirited new student, Mabel Clattersham, befriends her in class, Wonder's dreams seem to be coming true. As the girls grow closer, Wonder discovers her friend has a list of strange wishes. Throw a pie, leap into the sky, break someone's heart. What is Mabel's big secret? Can Wonder protect her heart from being broken all over again? The Heart Song of Wonder Quinn is an enchanting fairy tale celebrating friendship, bravery, and the importance of staying true to yourself.
Gorgeous. What genre would you classify this as?
I'd say this is lower middle grade magical realism.
Nice.
Yes.
And the word count?
Oh, probably be about 35K. So my perfect book.
Ticking all of your boxes today.
Yes.
Can you tell us more about it, please?
Sure. Wonder has lost her mother in a fire and in turn lost herself somewhat. She lives in the archives of Dyerleaf Hall, the school her mother once taught at. Her time at Dyerleaf Hall has mostly been fraught with sadness, never having made a friend in all the years. That is, until Mabel comes along. She may be small, but she has spirit aplenty. And first and foremost, she instantly becomes Wonder's friend. Trouble is, Mabel has a secret, one that may cause Wonder to lose herself all over again.
Beautiful. And the Dyerleaf Hall, that name. I think Kate Gordon has had that handle for a while.
Yes,
And I've always wondered.
She's been itching to explain it too, I think.
Yeah. Oh, well, we'll see it in the interview.
Yep.
And I know you enjoyed this book, didn't you, Julie?
Oh, I did. But before I talk about the actual book, I need to mention the way we came to know about it. So we received another book for review from UQP earlier in the year, and inside the package was a tiny little chocolate with the Wonder Quinn cover. It didn't sort of have the actual book written on it. It was just the image. And Giselle and I were immediately taken by the image, and we had to know more. So we looked it up and found that it was a forthcoming book. What a way to publicize a book with a little chocolate. I mean, that just had us. You had us at chocolate. So anyway, we had to have it. So we requested a copy and we waited patiently. And when it turned up, a black feather was enclosed in the packaging, and we knew we were in for something special. Now, the cover is by Rachel Trabue, and can I say I am completely smitten by it and have just added another rung on my list of illustrator crushes. Anyway, on to the book itself. Giselle read this to me at night with her lyrical little voice, and once again, I was captivated. Actually, I think I have to say this book was breathtaking. It kind of reminded me of Lee Battersby's Margaret in tone and themes, and I don't think I unclenched from my state of ugly crying for some time when the tale was finally done.
Oh,
yes. Now, the character of Wonder embeds deep in your heart from the first page, and when Mabel comes along, you're immediately hoping with all hope for a fairy tale friendship that will solve all of Wonder's problems and make her dreams come true. That is not to be, however, but do not fear. Before you reach the final page, Mabel and Wonder will grip you in their heart song and take you all the way to the stars. I believe I may not recover from the insane beauty of this one for a very long time, and I actually think it might be my current favourite read for 2020.
Wow.
Which is a big call.
Yeah, huge call.
Yep.
So, who will love this book? What age would it be perfect for?
This would be great for 8 to 12s and definitely for confident and reluctant readers alike.
Ah, so I'm now looking towards December, and
yes,
when we have a break from podcasting and we can read whatever we want, and starting to add to the pile.
Yes, this one must go on your pile. And yes, I know from Kate's lips that she is writing more in this series, which I am ecstatic about. So
nice.
Yep.
Very good.
Back to you, Pamela. What is the title of your second book?
Well, now I remember where I am in the year and the week and the day and everything like that. And that I'm actually doing two books for this one. So
yes,
three in one. And this is because I'm doing a duology, and it just made sense to read these back to back and do them together. And yep, the books are Monuments and Rebel Gods by Will Kostarkis. And Rebel Gods was just released in August on the 25th, published by Hachette. So I just thought I should read Monuments first, just, you know, there's only two of them. It just makes sense for me to read them both.
Yep.
Yeah.
So would you read the jacket blurb for us?
Yeah. So this is the jacket blurb for Rebel Gods. With the monuments gone, newbie gods Connor, Sally and Lockie must stop the rebel gods from reducing the world to ruin. Trouble is, they don't know how. While Sally searches for answers and Lockie makes plans to change the world, Connor struggles to keep up appearances as an ordinary teenager. But when a rebel god offers them a deal to end the chaos, their lives are turned upside down and they're forced to reckon with the question, who should decide the fate of the world?
Very exciting. And what genre would you class this as?
These are fantasy set in a contemporary world, which is interesting. And in terms of readership, they're right on the cusp of YA,
yep,
which you'll hear more about in my interview with Will, which was fantastic. Yeah.
Yep. another crossover.
Yeah, sort of. It's a little bit higher than the other two crossovers I've done, so I've kind of gone a little bit over the, but it still is, it's not fully YA, which is an interesting, you know, you listen, if you listen to the interview, you'll get why I'm saying that. Yeah, it's not fully in YA. So it's an interesting sort of murky area, and it's kind of nice to explore and just to see, you know, what can be done in that area and what needs to be done in that area. Yeah.
Definitely. And what is the estimated word count?
I think each one is about 70,000 words, I'd guess. Yeah.
Cool. And tell us about it.
Yeah, so in the book Monuments, we meet Connor, Sally and Lockie. They were just regular teens, but after they discover the location of the five monuments, who are creator gods who built the world and have been hidden under various schools around Sydney, things go pear-shaped. One by one, the monuments die and the three teens become the heirs to the monuments. That is, they become teen gods. Connor and Lockie are falling for one another and Sally is grieving for her parents, but they are now grappling with the fact that they have godly powers and will remain as teens forever. But while the monuments lived, their power contained the rebel gods, two sisters whose disagreement had plunged the world into war and chaos and had caused the death of a third sister. In the book, The Rebel Gods, Connor, Sally and Lockie have some tough choices to make. The monuments told them that they must kill the rebel gods immediately or the world will suffer. But cold-blooded killing doesn't feel right to the teens. They meet the first god, the god of love, and their hopes are raised that the rebel gods, who have been locked in the parallel, a sort of purgatory for thousands of years, have learned their lesson. And Lockie has grand visions of changing the world a little at a time. But no, it seems that the rebel gods' competitiveness has not diminished, and one of them reveals Lockie's god status to the public, and so the teen gods have a battle ahead of them to save the world and find their place in it.
Wow, intricate.
Yeah, well, that's two novels in one there.
Yeah.
But you kind of have to know the beginning to know, you know, where it's going. But quite involved.
And what was your overall enjoyment?
Yeah, I really enjoyed these. They're such a great mix of fantasy, reality, humour, time travel and the heart. You know, as I mentioned, they're on the lower end of YA. So they're a great step up for those who are looking for something a bit meatier than middle grade, but not yet ready for full on YA, which is often verging on adult these days. So it meant that Will could raise some interesting questions within a fast-paced fantasy. But most of all, I wanted to find out how the story of these teen gods would finish up. And I really enjoyed the twist at the end and how it ended, which I won't reveal. But yeah, really good fun. Yeah.
And who will love this book? What age would you recommend it for?
I think it's a really fantastic book or duology for reluctant reader older kids, especially boys. And as you'll hear from Will in the interview, it's great for kids in early high school, so about 12 or 13 plus. And yeah, do stick around for the interview. It was a really interesting chat.
Yes. Well, that's it for our reviews, but don't run away. Not only does Pamela chat to Will Kostakis, I had the absolute honour of speaking to Kate Gordon. So stay tuned, folks.
And we'll see you next time. Will Kostakis is an award-winning author for young adults. His first novel, Loathing Lola, was released when he was just 19, and his second, The First Third, won the 2014 Gold Inkey Awards. Rebel Gods is the thrilling conclusion to Monuments, which was a 2019 CBCA notable book. Welcome to the podcast, Will. It's great to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, so Rebel Gods, it's the heart-stopping conclusion to the duology that you began with Monuments. And I have to say, I just finished it today, so I'm kind of on that little bit of high of the end of the book.
Well, that's what I want to hear. Oh, I finished it. It was okay.
No, I don't think you ever hear that, especially not from me. But yeah, no, I am right there. So can you tell us a little bit about how this duology came about?
So I just finished sort of my heaviest novel, which was The Sidekicks, which was heavily inspired by the death of my closest friend in high school, and sort of rebuilding myself in the wake of that. And spending 2 years writing that, I ended up sort of depressing the hell out of myself, basically. Wow. And I needed some way to pick myself back up. And it was fantasy novels, the fantasy novels that my friend introduced me to, that helped me grieve him when he was gone. And so when I thought about what I could write as a sort of antidote to what I was feeling, I was drawn to fantasy. And I was one of those kids. I was a massive daydreamer. I would press my head against the glass of a train and I would imagine this epic sprawling fantasy playing out across Sydney's rooftops. And I realized sort of in the wake of The Sidekicks that I wanted to finally write that fantasy novel I'd been putting off. And I quickly realized that it was going to be a series. I'm too afraid of getting hit by a bus to write a series that's 7 books long. So I thought two books is good, in and out, sort of split my ideas in half and decided, okay, the challenge I set myself with the first book, which is Monuments, you know, my books are usually a response to what the book that I wrote previously. So The Sidekicks was quite slow and meditative. So Monuments was designed to be a rapid page turner that didn't sort of, I don't want to say didn't concern itself with emotions, but wasn't overly preoccupied with that stuff. I just wanted to write a story that had a huge narrative thrust, knowing full well that the next book that I wrote, the conclusion, would sort of tap into all of the sort of emotions and the conflicts that I seeded in that first book and sort of take them to their hopefully most logical conclusion. And so Monuments is this, you know, super fun, super light page turning adventure about three teenagers who skip school to find the ancient gods that are buried under different Sydney high schools. You know, I pitch it to teenagers as Legend of Zelda set in Sydney, and then Rebel Gods sees those three teenagers contending with that first adventure and the consequences of that adventure, but also realizing how much it changed them for better and for worse, and then sort of contending with growing up.
Yeah. And what you say about the power of story, I mean, that was going to be one of my later questions. You know, right now, you know, we were talking about before, we locked down here in Melbourne and the world's not in a great place. And you just come to realize just how powerful story is and how much it can really affect your life and pull you forward and take you away.
Yeah, completely. And it's, you know, I started writing Monuments as a sort of antidote to how I was feeling. And then, you know, Rebel Gods ended up being my escape from lockdown at the beginning of this year, because I wrote most of this book, like, well, I started it in October last year. The version that you're reading, it really came to fruition at the end of March, beginning of April. So at the height of that uncertainty, this book was my escape from the news. It was really funny. I started writing, you know, Rebel Gods and Monuments to escape what I thought was a really mundane contemporary realism space. And now contemporary realism is sort of like fantasy. Like, we are living in this really strange, all the rules of realism have been thrown out of the window. So it'll be so fascinating to see how novels change in the years ahead.
Definitely. So when you were writing Monuments, did you know where Rebel Gods was going to go plot-wise? Did you have an idea for that?
I had an idea. So I had sort of the antagonist was already built in my head, and I knew, you know, the shape that they would take and how I would deal with that conflict. That changed dramatically over the years. You know, at first I was like, you know what, in the first book, I'm going to hype up these villains. And then in book two, I'm going to do a sleight of hand and say, actually, those villains don't matter. I'm going to tell you a story about growing up. And then, you know, so I wrote the first book and most of my editorial notes were, we'll amp up the threat of the villains. We've got to amp up that threat. This is a series. And so I went back and I kept amping up that threat and building it and making all these promises to the reader. And then when I wrote the first draft of Rebel Gods, that sort of undoes all of that. The publisher was like, oh, Will, you've broken your promise to the reader.
Right. Yeah.
And this was my first sequel. So I really had to, you know, understand that it's not like I've got a twist halfway through a novel. And in my head, I see it as one big story, but, you know, people have gone and made two separate purchases. So it is, you know, there is a contract that they have entered into with me. And so if I go against that, then it feels like a betrayal. And the first book changed shape so much and the hype was built around these villains that I couldn't possibly follow my original plan for the sequel. But, you know, for me, things happen by accident when I'm writing, and it is the process of writing that allows me to sort of discover what the story is. And yeah, so even though Rebel Gods isn't exactly as I pictured it, it's the story that I found as I was writing it.
Right. And my next question was going to be, and we've already talked about this a bit, is, you know, that Rebel Gods adds a deeper, more reflective aspect looking at society and religion and difference. And, you know, you said how you wrote this at the start of lockdown. So, you know, were those topics, were they a natural evolution that, you know, that came out of the writing process, or did you plan to address those aspects early on?
I did. I had a lot of things, and, you know, I'm talking about a story where three teenagers become gods. And so we watch how society picks apart teenagers who, you know, get too big for their boots. Like, we watched what happened with the climate change protests. And originally the first draft of Rebel Gods really reflected, you know, our attitudes towards teenagers sort of skipping school and trying to, you know, change the world for the better. But there were these things I realized that if I tried to make it too tied to the political moment, that political moment has changed 7 or 8 times since those climate strike marches, which were the end of last year. And so there were things that remained constant, though. I wanted to look at the gods that we as humans have created, which is, you know, the gods of established religions, the gods of media. And I was really, really fascinated in who we give power to and then what they do with that power. And then contrasting that with our three teen heroes who I hope are noble and setting a good example. And I wanted to see, okay, how would teenagers behave if they were the inheritors of the powers of the creator gods? And so I always wanted to have those things playing off each other, but it's just, you know, one draft of the book was too heavily critical of Christianity, so I stripped that back. One draft of the book was too heavily rooted in media analysis, so I stripped it back. And so it was just, it was finding the right sort of tone. And I realized that I couldn't just use this book to just rant about the things that I saw in society and didn't like, if that makes sense. I realized at the core of the story, and the biggest promise that I made to the reader, was that they were going to see the continuation of Connor's story, Locke's story, Sally's story. And I realized I was telling a story about these three teenagers growing up and their relationship with each other. And so, yes, on the fringes, you still get that sort of critique of the media, the critique of established religion, perhaps misusing its power. But ultimately, this is about those three teenagers.
Yeah, I guess you have to kind of, you know, you've got these gods in modern day society. You kind of have to address those things. You can't ignore them. And was it fun writing, you know, these teenagers who now have these powers, these godlike powers, and they're never going to age? Was it fun writing sort of their reaction to that? Was it difficult?
It was, but it was difficult balancing the tone, because there is an inherent tragedy in their situation. And, you know, this was something they, you know, Connor was never explained, look, this is what's going to happen to you. And there is that sort of melancholy that seeps into his story once he realizes what's happened to him. But I had to keep reminding myself, I'm writing a story that ultimately I wanted it to be fun. And so getting to see them use their powers in really interesting ways, I made a list of all sort of the ways a reader would expect them to use their powers, but then I wanted to make sure there were moments in each of their arcs where they got to use their power in a surprising way. But, you know, it's no secret to most people that I find writing the contemporary realism side of stories far easier. That is where I am most comfortable. And I had a really wonderful editor in Sophie Mayfield who would constantly remind me, Will, it's been 30 pages. Our gods haven't done anything godly recently. You need to sort of like make that happen on the next page. And so she kept me in line and she was my fantasy guru throughout all of this. But I've always been more fascinated by their humanity. Even though they became gods over the course of the first book, I'm still really interested in who they are and how they feel. And, you know, part of me wanted to write a sequel where there was no powers being used, but then that would have just been incredibly boring. And again, betraying that promise that I made in the first book.
Yeah. And it's difficult with fantasy as well, because fantasy is such a fixed genre, I guess, and it's so grounded in good versus evil. But, you know, it's been done a lot as well. So you do need to kind of think of how you're going to do fantasy in a different way and, you know, for kids as well or for YA and not disappoint your reader. Yeah. So there's a lot of things to juggle there.
And I realized the way that I would do that subversion was that, you know, I'd built up that the bad guys at the end of the first book and I was sort of stuck with them. But I realized my way into this story, and I realized this in about March, April, was that I was telling a story about hesitation, about having something placed on you that you possibly weren't equipped to handle. And that's when everything sort of clicked and I realized I was writing a, you know, urban fantasy version of Hamlet. And once I realized that was my in for the rest of the book.
Love it. And the books are set in Sydney, which adds a really nice, relatable sense of reality. Now, I don't really know Sydney very well, but it, you know, it made Connor relatable, even though he's a god. Were the Sydney locations and the schools in particular, were they real?
So the schools in the first book were amalgamations of different schools that I've visited, and based on the different rumors. So whenever I would visit a school, I would ask kids, okay, what's the big rumor you've heard about your school? If a school was a certain age, let's say if the school had been opened during World War II, then there was always the rumor about the bunkers that still existed. And there were all these awesome urban legends about schools. And so I melded them together. And so, and I sometimes staff members would give me sneaky tours of sort of the backs of schools, and I got to see just some really interesting rooms that had been almost frozen in time from the 1960s and 70s that just sort of hadn't been touched and were used for storage. And it was really fascinating seeing that and then getting to sort of put that into the book. But in terms of, yes, so those schools, they're all fictional, but I can, if I'm visiting one of the schools that heavily influenced the book, then I'll tell the kids and they genuinely like that, but I try to keep that a secret between me and them. But in terms of the locations, especially the locations in the second book, you know, my aim was to write on location, sort of plonk myself down and write, and then the pandemic happened, and so I did a lot of my writing with Google Maps opened, which wasn't ideal, and it was sort of, I felt like a tourist in my own city. And so I really narrowed the focus of sort of where the story was set. And so I ended up setting most of it in my backyard here in Redfern. And yeah, it was, and I tried to keep that as true to the Sydney that I know as I could, but without being really overly prescriptive to, okay, there is a street here. They have to walk 5 minutes to get to this street. Because then it just sort of, it loses that, it's a boring kind of realism. Whereas I wanted the story to still feel sort of light and fun and still showing Sydney in a different, more fantastical light.
Yeah, I think stories based in Australian cities are sort of in demand at the moment. I've heard publishers are looking for them because, you know, they're more relatable to kids, and it doesn't matter if it's fantasy or contemporary, but the setting is, you know, more relatable than if it's in a European forest or, you know, in London or, yeah, overseas.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether they're more in demand. I think there's always been a demand for Australian stories, but the funny thing is when I meet teenagers and I try to tell them, hey, you know, I remember reading a book that was set in Darwin when I was in high school and it just completely blew my mind. I tell them that and they're like, oh yeah, but you know what? This is where my favorite YouTuber is from, or this is my favorite TV show on Netflix and it's set here. And so they actually love reading about, let's say, LA or New York. And I find that when I read their creative writing, a lot of their creative writing is steeped in the Americanisms that they've consumed. And so I actually think, I'm sure it's different for primary school. And I would actually even say that it's probably definitely different for middle grade readers. But as they get older into teen, I think they're drawn to not only stories with an American setting, but they're drawn to stories written by Americans in an American setting.
Interesting. And sort of related to that, the book is set in 2020, which is going to be interesting going forward, given that you failed to predict.
I know, look, and there was such an attention to detail, like I got the gods exactly right. I remember being really bitter because the first book is set in March 2020.
Yeah.
And let's just say that's not the March that happened.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, wow, that's really annoying. But then I realized, wait, I'm writing a book that features gods and all time travel and all this other stuff. And I'm like, I think it's okay that there's no pandemic here.
It'll be fine. Yeah. But what it does mean being set in 2020 is that technology plays a large part. And I know for some authors, contemporary technology makes plotting difficult because everyone has a phone and a camera, and it doesn't really help when you're trying to write a mystery or a thriller, and it can date a book. But you embraced it. Did you put a lot of thought into how tech would be used, or research into how teens use tech these days?
Well, I visit enough schools and sort of keep as engaged with teenagers as I can. So I understand how sort of tech works in their lives. And I think about how it sort of intrudes on mine. But, you know, to that point, I don't think it makes storytelling harder. I think it's certainly, there's a challenge. And yes, you can't get away with a lot of things that you would otherwise. But I'm writing a story for, you know, kids 12 plus who are living now. And if I always set my stories in the mid to late 90s where this technology hasn't sort of come about, I'm cheating and I'm really writing stories that are nostalgic for me and nostalgic for adults. I'm not really writing stories for the teenagers of today. And yes, there are challenges with technology. You can't have something happen where, you know, if a teenager wants to see something, you know, they'll get their phone out and they'll take a photo of it or things like that to help them remember. But there are easy storytelling ways to get around that. You can have somebody lose their phone, smash their phone, have a phone run out of battery, because that happens to us every day when we're allowed to leave our houses.
Yep.
So I'll push back against that idea that it's more difficult. I think it's our job to reflect the world as it exists now. I'm cautious about writing a book that is more for me, whether that is making it easier for me to write by, you know, stripping out technology, or, you know, gives me the warm fuzzies because it reminds me of my childhood. I don't like the idea of doing that at the expense of writing something that speaks to the truth of kids' experiences now, because I find that, you know, for every storytelling opportunity that technology closes, it opens hundreds and thousands of other opportunities. And we can't worry about technology dating our work, because my first book was released in 2008. Kids in that book don't have smartphones. That is really dated now. Like, you know, and that wasn't, that was 12 years ago. And that was sort of on the cusp then. And so, yeah, I think worrying about dating your work is a really strange worry, because, you know, we talk about books set in the 60s and we say, oh, they're so timeless. Well, no, they're not. They reflect that time period really, really well. Yep. We were just told that, you know, it's the canon and that's it. And, you know, how many times do you have to translate Shakespeare and then, you know, look up, what does this word mean? What did it mean in context? What is the what's the contextual thing that he is alluding to there? And so whenever we look at an older text, we're always sort of picking apart what an author meant by it. And we just need to make sure our stories are relevant to our audiences now. And like it or not, technology is a really huge part of their lives.
Yeah. And especially if you're addressing a particular audience, if you're looking at young teens, especially reluctant readers, you know, they want to be able to relate in some way.
Exactly. You know,
and to have that action going on. I think Rick Riordan, I think in Magnus Chase, my son loves Magnus Chase. And I think one of the things he loves is that melding of fantasy and contemporary, you know, humour as well. Yeah. So as you were writing, Will, who was your target audience? Who did you have in mind for this book?
So I always had in mind a younger audience than the sidekicks in the first third. So the sidekicks was very much the oldest I would push YA. A lot of that was the subject matter, dealing with grief as well, but also because, you know, I put in about 50 F-bombs and I thought, great, the publisher's going to cut out all of them, and then they cut out none of them. And I'm like, oh, okay, that happened. And so the other thing was, as I was touring schools and beginning to tour more primary schools, I kept encountering, you know, librarians and, you know, kids themselves who were itching to read a little above where they were sort of quote unquote supposed to. And the books that they were reaching for, you know, they weren't allowed to read contemporary novels for older kids because that would be inappropriate, but they were reading fantasy novels, but they ended up going towards the fantasy novels that, you know, are like some of the Sarah J. Maas books that are more adult than YA, but they look like YA books, and they were drawn to those books. And, you know, time and again, librarians were telling me that they were sort of struggling with finding books for that, for the younger kids who were interested in YA, wanted to be able to have the bragging rights of reading YA, but while they could understand all of the words on the page, they, you know, they just weren't, they weren't connecting with it as best that they could. And it, you know, it was perhaps a little too daunting for them. And that was in the back of my mind as I was writing it. And I just organically realized that I could talk about all the things that I wanted to without, at least the first book, you know, losing any of its, it, you know, without it damping my vision in any way. So I wrote Monuments as the first draft was more solidly middle grade. And then with discussions with publishers, and we spoke about sort of what people would expect from me, we aged it up a little bit, but never veered too far into territory that would be inappropriate. So for me, in my mind, I had two readers. There was the 16-year-old who would read all of my books and then pick this one up, and there would still be something for them, and perhaps some jokes for them that the younger kids wouldn't get. But also, you know, an avid, you know, 12-year-old reader could pick it up and devour it and just disappear into this world. With Rebel Gods, Rebel Gods is the sort of continuation, and it's sort of, it's holding their hand, you know, into more, I don't want to say adult themes, but into more young adult themes. And I think Rebel Gods is more firmly a young adult novel, but again, there's no swearing, and it's, you know, compared to all of my books, it's definitely on the tamer side of things. So I wanted to write, you know, I don't like the word crossover because it feels like it's sort of a marketing decision has been made. But for me, it was that I wanted to write a young adult novel that a reader who, you know, feels like they can read up, it's a safe space for them to read up. And also I was picturing that younger version of myself, that Will who was in year five and year six, who, you know, knew that he was different. He knew that he was gay, and, you know, it wasn't something he was, not so much something that he was wrestling with, but it was something that he was like, okay, that's a thing. I'm just going to put a pin in that, or just squash it way down and just not think about it for a few years. And while queer representation has changed for the better and the way that society talks about LGBTQIA plus people and issues has changed even the past 3 or 4 years, you know, for the better, I still thought about that version of me, and he would probably want to see somebody like him getting to go on an adventure and getting to live a full life and have a healthy relationship with someone. And so I didn't want to exclude that 11-year-old version of me from reading that, because I think that would help him come to terms with himself a whole lot faster.
Yeah, that's right. I see there seems to be a bit of a shift, you know, this, like you said, crossover. There's this new sort of, I've done a couple of crossover books now, and yours being sort of on the upper end of that. But, you know, YA seems to be, it's read by a lot of adults now. And so that seems to
100%.
Be... 100%. Yeah.
And the big YA novels, especially recently, they're mostly adults who are talking about it, sharing it. And that's not to say that teenagers aren't connecting with it, but I do think that we have to be quite vigilant as YA writers, you know, to say, look, we're writing books for teenagers. We're not writing books for adults. It's a lot easier to market it to adults. They have more money and a lot of them grew up reading Harry Potter and they sort of love reading about teenagers still. But it's just because sometimes, and we have initiatives like Teens to the Front where we make sure that we make space for teenagers in discussions about teen novels and, you know, involve them in events for teen novels. But, you know, even something like this pandemic, our opportunities to connect with teens, our opportunities to hand sell to teens have dwindled dramatically. And, you know, I'm not the sort of person who, you know, a teenager might follow me on Instagram, but I'm not talking to teenagers, if that makes sense. So it is that you can see the books that are sort of rising are books that are appealing to adults. And I think, and there were times when I was writing The Sidekicks where I was like, oh, am I writing this for a teenager or am I writing this for 26-year-old William? And I had to sort of pull myself back, and it's this constant sort of holding myself to account. And, you know, if I want to write about or write for adults, I should be writing adult and, you know, not take up space and oxygen in the teen market.
Yeah. And you've got quite advanced middle grade readers. So, you know, they're reading all of Harry Potter because they can back to back.
Yeah.
You know, and then they're reading Percy Jackson. I mean, my kids have read most of those books now already. And you know, my eldest is not even 10 in a few weeks. So then there's the question of where do they go from there? You know, if they're 11 or 12 and they've read all those books, where do they go from there? So it's nice to see some of these books coming in and filling that space before they jump into full on YA.
Yeah. And the really funny thing is the most common, I don't want to say criticism I got from Monuments, was that I had adult readers criticize it for being younger than The Sidekicks. And I was like, yeah, but it's not for you. it's this really funny thing where, I don't know. And I guess it is because it does exist in a weird space, you know, that younger YA space that isn't really as defined as, say, solidly middle grade or solidly YA. And that's, look, you know, I had those noble goals of wanting to fill that gap for young readers. Would I do it again? Probably not. It's been a marketing headache.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But I think there is a gap in the market, and not a gap in the market that I want to exploit or make money off. It's the Will who goes into schools and sees, hey, there need to be more books for those teenagers and all those, you know, on the cusp of teens, kids. So that was what sort of motivated me to write the first book. And I'm happy that I did it. Would I do it again? Probably not. Just because I think, well, especially the adults who come to YA, didn't feel like they got enough out of it. And that sort of, and it's been difficult to reach those teens and those tweens in a pandemic.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
exactly. We were just starting to, I was just starting to get sort of fan mail from kids in year six, and it was starting to build momentum in February of this year. And then it sort of all sort of ground to a halt. So, you know, if you speak to me in 5 years' time and this has sort of taken off, then I'm like, well, yes, I didn't doubt myself for an instant. But at the moment, I'm like, yeah, doubting myself. But at the same time, I'm so proud of these books, and I'm so proud of sort of what they've accomplished and sort of what I've accomplished in writing them. So, yeah.
Well, they should be on the shelves for a while, and the covers are fantastic. I really like the covers as well. Yeah. So hopefully they'll attract some readers.
Yeah, the whole packaging is really, really great.
Yeah. Going back to what you were talking about with teenagers wanting to read about America and read about, you know, other countries and you know, worlds that they're not in. When I was a teenager, I wanted to write, you know, I wanted to be a writer from quite young. But when I was a teenager, I thought, well, I'm boring. What am I going to write? You know, I'm not one of these people that has an interesting life or a lot of experience or anything, you know, really interesting to write about. You got published when you were 19. How did you get there? You know, did you always want to be a writer, and what obstacles did you have to overcome to get there?
Always wanted to be a writer. I was in the back seat of my car. I remember in like year three, looking at the back of my sort of tattered copy of Maurice Gleitzman's Misery Guts and imagining my face over his, you know, with a caption that said Will Kostakis, you know, 9-year-old author. And, you know, I was sending books off from when I was in year seven, kept getting rejection letters all the way through to year 12 when a publisher said yes. So it was a solid 6 years of rejection letters, which was horrid, but that was them telling me I wasn't ready. And that was true. And I still don't think I was ready when I did get a book deal at 17. When I tell people that I got a book deal at 17, they look at me and they hate me. There are two halves to that story. One, there were many rejection letters and a lot of heartbreak. And two, if I had the chance to go back, probably wish they gave me a few more rejection letters, because nobody is their best, most complete self at 17. And, you know, when I released my book at 19, you can tell that it was written by a 19-year-old boy who was desperate to be liked. It was just boob joke, fart joke, typo. Like, but I love it dearly, but it's not, it's not in the literary classic section, let's just say that. And the book I wrote in my early 20s was much better, much more honest, and I'd sort of found my voice. But more interesting part of that question was, you mentioned that you thought, you know, your life was boring when you were a teenager. And it's something I come across time and time again when I'm talking to teenagers. And your life is boring to you. There is something special. There is a spark in your life. Like, there's a reason why when something happens to you, you want to call your friends and tell them about it. Like, we are natural born storytellers, and we are living sort of the best story that there is. I remember I was talking to a group of teenagers, and a girl in the front row was adamant that her life was boring. And I'm like, why is your life boring? And she's like, oh, look, I'm a rower. And I'm like, okay, so what do you do? She's like, I row like 5 days a week. I'm like, oh, what happens at rowing? She's like, we just row. And I'm like, okay, she's giving me nothing. But I was like, so nothing interesting has ever happened to you at rowing practice? And I'm thinking she's going to talk about, you know, an argument with her friend or something. She's like, nah, nothing's ever happened. And I'm feeling exasperated at this point. And then I watch her facial expression shift slightly, and she goes, oh, actually, yeah, like last Tuesday we found a body.
Oh, jeez.
And I'm just staring at her like, wow. Are you kidding me? But we're all too close to our lives.
Yeah.
We think that they're boring. Yeah. And the things that we think are annoying, like our conversations with our parents, you know, all those things, we are living stories that we'll connect with others because, you know, we all like to think we're unique snowflakes. We're not. But we're all living experiences that others have lived some kind of an echo of, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And Yeah, I think once you look for the magic in your own life and you look for that special something, then you can use that as the engine for a story. But the wonderful thing about creative writing is you can write something totally and completely outside your experiences, and that's fine too.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I just wish I'd, you know, I mean, I still think my life's boring, but I want to write, so now I just do it. Whereas, you know, I didn't have the courage back then, you know, as a teenager. And I went to a school where if you were wanted to be a writer, it was going to, you were going to be a journalist. You know, that was where you were going to go. But, you know, it's also interesting what you said, that you did this apprenticeship of 6 years where you were getting rejection letters and you needed that. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of aspiring writers nowadays don't realise that. They just want to be, you know, they want their first thing to, you know, I'm the next one whose first manuscript is going to come out. You know, I'm going to get off the slush pile, even though thousands and thousands of other people don't get off the slush pile, you know. And you do need to, after a few years, you do need to kind of sit down and go, okay, this is my apprenticeship. Mm-hmm. I will get that. I'll get there when I'm ready. And what is it that I want my first manuscript to be that's on the shelves, you know?
Exactly. And the thing is, like, publishers can see through a really, really rough story and find sort of the diamond within it. And the thing that I learned that I knew I had to do, and the big difference between, because the quality of my writing didn't jump that much between year 10 and year 12. I just became more honest in my writing. And so the big thing I say is tell the truth. It can be your truth or a truth that you've perceived about the world, but tell a truth, and that will is what will connect with people. And that's, I spent so much time in my sort of early, I say early years, but like, you know, year 7, year 8, year 9, writing these stories where I was trying so desperately to sound smart and trying so desperately to write the best book ever. I'm talking about 7,000 similes per page. You know, I was like, this is going to be art. And once I sort of climbed out of my own ass and realized, you know what, I'm just going to reflect on something truthfully. That was what made a publisher sit up and go, oh, wait, this is something.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic that a publisher, you know, took you on at such a young age as well.
Yeah. But I don't think, and I always sort of get a shudder when I see a publisher has signed on a young writer, because, you know, it's a really strange relationship where you work with an editor almost every single day. You're texting, especially at the end, you're texting, you know, 7 or 8 times a day, exchanging emails. And then the book comes out, you know, they celebrate you, take you out to lunch, and then nothing. It's like you had this close working relationship and then these people just vanish off the face of the earth. And that's something for an adult to come to terms with. It's quite difficult. For a 19-year-old, that was shattering. And, you know, that was, you know, you realize, hey, you know, we're only as good as the contract that we have. And once that contract is fulfilled, like, you know, they move on to the next book and the next author, you know, that needs to be released or it needs to be edited. And so it is a juggling act, and the industry is barely equipped to cater to the mental health and sort of the things that adults need to sort of survive in it. It's definitely not equipped to help children through the system.
Yeah.
So I'm always quite hesitant, like when a teenager comes up to me and I see that sort of determination that I had and that absolute drive, I'm like, this is wonderful, but oh my god, just wait one more year, because that extra year, because, you know, everyone hears the positive side of my story, which was, yeah, when I was 17, a publisher said we'd love to publish you. Then when I was 19, weeks after the first book came out, that same publisher was like, we don't want to publish you anymore. And for the first time in my life, I had writer's block, and it went for years.
Wow.
And confidence was completely wiped away. And, you know, books last on the shelves in a bookstore for 3 months and then they're returned. And so I achieved my dream, but then it was the greatest thing, but it was the cruelest thing, because your dream will never, ever, 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 ever way up to what you imagined it would be. And my career in the 10 years since has been realizing what a more realistic version of that life is and coming to terms with it. Like, I'm sure, you know, we all sort of dream of, you know, notoriety and fame and, you know, being able to live off our royalties but there are very few authors who get to do that. And it's, you know, it's a very lucky chosen few that get to. And if you told me at 17 that I would be 31 walking into schools and having to introduce myself rather than be known, I would be like, oh, I'm a failure. But you know what? Now, as a 31-year-old, who am I? I get to write stories that I'm passionate about. I get to do what I love for a living. And, you know, I would be happy sharing my stories with my friends as I did in high school, but I have readers who clamor for the next book that I write, who, you know, send me emails. I get emails from kids from year five, you know, through to year 12, who tell me, who send me quotes of things that I've written that has helped shape their lives. And, you know, I wouldn't trade that for anything. And so while, you know, this career that I'm living isn't that big, sparkly, unrealistic thing that I imagined, I am so deeply thankful for that I get to do this every single day, and I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world.
Yeah, sounds amazing. I mean, it's a different world from what it was 10 years ago as well. I think in terms of publishing, there's no longer a state of authors, you know, publishers are loyal to authors and authors are loyal to publishers. It's you're all about your next book, who wants it. So as you know, if you can make a career out of that, even if it's just a, you know, modest career and paying the bills and you being able to write, that's amazing. And yeah, well done you, and keep going with it. Can't wait for the next book.
Well, it comes out next month.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Which, yeah, look, it's been a busy year. Let's just say that. I am an Australia Reads ambassador. So it was formerly Australian Reading Hour. And so when you're an ambassador for them, they are like, great, you can be an ambassador for us. And I'm like, that's awesome. They're like, we'd like you to write a book. And I'm like, oh, another one. And I'm so I've written an 80-page novella, and it's set during lockdown in Melbourne, during coronavirus, because I wrote it in April, May of this year was the first draft. And when I first sort of devised it, my publisher was like, oh, you know, coronavirus will be over by then. Surprise. Yes. So it's this really weird thing where, because of the timeline with writing a novel, you can come up with an idea, spend a year really thinking about it, a year writing it, then a year editing it. And by the time it comes out, if it was really timely at the beginning of that process, it is no longer timely at the end of it. Yep. But this, because of the timeline we were on, you know, I started writing it in April and it's coming out now in November. Wow. It's allowed me to tell a smaller story that really captures the uncertainty of this moment, but also sort of the hope for the future. So I'm really excited for everyone to read The Greatest Hit when it releases.
Oh, great.
Later this year.
The Greatest Hit. Fantastic. Yeah, that turnaround is amazing.
Yeah, it was exhausting, and I will never, ever, ever write two novels at the same time ever again, because I was, you know, knee deep in sort of fantasy land. And then once I submitted that book, they were like, oh yeah, by the way, your second draft of the lockdown story is due. And I'm like, oh, so I was jumping between this sort of fantastical world and the grim reality we were all living in and sort of bouncing between them. And it was just, it turned my brain to mush.
Wow. Well, at least you can say you were bored all through lockdown.
Look, yeah, I was preoccupied, and now I've given myself time to just sort of pause and think.
Yeah, that's good. I know it's hard for everyone. I know you're in Sydney, not so locked down as we are in Melbourne, but it is a hard time to be creative. Mm. Okay, so we better push on, Will. Are you ready for our six quick questions?
Yep, bring them on.
Not too difficult, don't worry. Keyboard or pen and paper?
Keyboard when I need to smash something through, but if I feel blocked, pen and paper. That's a politician answer. But yeah, look, most of my books are typed, so I'll go with keyboard.
Favorite writing snack?
Chocolate.
Nice. Tea or coffee?
Neither.
Oh, there you go.
Well, Actually, Rebel Gods was the first book that I actually needed to rely on caffeine to write. So I'll answer coffee. It was, you know, I discovered iced coffees, which are amazing. Just nice. An iced long black. But yes. I pride myself on not needing caffeine. But now, you know, in my old age of early 30s, I find that I need help waking up sometimes.
Yes, once you get into it, you can't stop.
Yeah.
I'm a tea person anyway. Ebook or the real thing?
Real thing.
Cats or dogs?
I am a proud father of two cats, so I'm going to have to say cats because they're in the room. But
and there was a cat.
But we all know what that means, and yeah. I'll just leave it at that.
And there was a cat in Rebel Gods, but
yes, that cat is currently on my lap.
Well, there we go.
So yeah, Yuki, she is. So both of my cats have now worked their way into my stories. So yeah, she's quite a regal little thing.
And last one, comedy or tragedy?
That's the thing. I always laugh at the saddest, most tragic things. So I think it's just I can't choose between. No, it has to be comedy because I'm always laughing.
Okay. And Rebel Gods is out now from all good bookstores. And where can our listeners find you if they want to know you, more about you, Will?
Look, it's not difficult to find me. I am a bit shameless. So just type my name into Google. You should be able to find me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube. But honestly, I'm wherever. I'm probably driving past your house twice a week with a megaphone screaming, love me, love me, love me. So I am that guy.
You can do that a bit more when your audience are teens, can't you, than when they're sort of younger kids. You can appeal to your readers, I think, a bit more. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much for joining us today, Will. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed myself.
Kate Gordon grew up in a very bookish house in a small town by the sea in Tasmania. In 2009, she won a Varuna Fellowship. Kate's first book, Three Things About Daisy Blue, was published in 2010. Since then, she has published a number of books. Her most recent publication are the young adult novel Girl Running, Boy Falling, and the young reader series Juno Jones, Word Ninja. Kate's next book is The Ballad of Elodie Rose, which will be published in 2021 with UQP. So hi, Kate, and welcome to Middle Grade Mavens.
Thank you so much for having me. It's delightful. I'm a huge fan of the show, so it's amazing to actually be on here.
Oh, we're so amazed when people say they're actually listening. So thank you, Kate.
I listen every episode, so this is slightly surreal.
Beautiful. So, Kate, we've reviewed your lovely Juno Jones junior fiction novel, which was fabulous, and congrats on your latest release, The Heart Song of Wonder Quinn.
Thank you.
Now, from reading your website, you have books in almost all of the kidlit age groups. Tell us, where did this incredible literary journey start for Kate Gordon?
Oh, can I just say first, it completely blew my mind just then when you reminded me that the first one came out in 2010, because that is actually 10 years ago now, and I'm feeling ancient. I mean, you said in your introduction that I grew up in a very bookish household, and it's a fairly boring, ordinary story for authors. I grew up surrounded by books. I had two English teacher librarian parents. Oh. I was always the kid growing up who'd get in trouble for reading in class and read after lights out, and would be sitting in the library when the other kids were out playing. And I think that that's a very traditional story, but I just grew up surrounded by books. I never thought that I could actually be a writer of books. I grew up in a small sort of country town, and it just wasn't something that I even conceived of. And then when I was in high school, the writer Stephen Herrick came and talked at my school, and he was just this down-to-earth, personable, regular man, and not the sort of superstar celebrity writer I'd envisaged, and just made me feel like, oh, if he can do it and be this incredible writer and be just a regular person, maybe I can too.
Brilliant.
Which was, and now I'm in the same publishing house with him, which blows my mind completely.
Fantastic. Oh, that's brilliant. So The Heart Song of Wonder Quinn is an exquisite read. And this one feels like it might be from your heart song. So where did you get the inspiration for this beautiful book?
It's funny, my daughter, who's 8 years old, insisted on doing a mock interview with me this morning. She likes, you know, running through it and preparing.
Oh, beautiful.
And I was telling this story and halfway through she yawned and she said, "Mum, you need to make this a little bit brighter and pithier so people are more intrigued by it." Basically, we now live in Hobart, which if people know their Tasmanian geography, it's right down the bottom of Tasmania. Yep. But I grew up on the northwest coast and most of our family still live in the northwest coast. So we regularly travel the length of Tasmania, which I know is not very long by Australian standards, but it feels like a long trip with a small kid in the car. Yep. But we travel all the way through the middle of Tasmania, which is called imaginatively the Midlands. And it's basically, I always picture it as like a Wuthering Heights sort of gothic. It's got kind of a dark gothic history and it's all very sparse landscapes and these kind of twisted trees and the odd random old building in it that might still be occupied but probably has ghosts. And so whenever we drive through, I would just think, I have to set a story here. I have to set a story here. And then on one of these trips, I just had in my head a little girl with dark hair and dark eyes sitting on a roof of, there's a building called Horton House or Horton Hall that used to be in the Midlands and is now just like a doorway that just sits in the middle of the Midlands. So you drive through and you just see this doorway. So I imagined a girl sitting on this old Gothic building and just the line that Wonder Quinn was sitting on the roof of Dyleaf Hall with her friend Hollowbeak the Crow just came into my head and it just stuck in there.
Magical.
Yeah, and it kind of was one of those gifts that you get as a writer where basically just the whole thing just popped into my head. So Tasmania is definitely an inspiration for that sort of story.
Oh, that's beautiful. And will you share, I mean, so many people talk about how they write every day and, you know, if you don't, then you're not a writer. Is that the kind of process that you follow or what is your way of getting words down?
I mean, as all of your listeners will know, 2020 has been a strange beast, so it's not been my usual process. I do write full time. This is my job. So I'm very lucky that I have that. Basically, while my daughter's at school, that's writing time. And it wasn't always that way. I started 2011, I think I started doing it full time. And then I had tests in 2012. And then for 4 years, I basically didn't do much at all. But since she's been at school, her school time has been my writing time. So I basically treat it as a job. Yep. And I sit down and I do it between, I have a break for lunch. I get dressed even during homeschooling times. I'd get dressed in, you know, I mean, I'm a bit of a dag, so not really kind of fancy looking clothes, but clothes at least. And I sit down and I just work between those hours and I don't have a word count limit. And when I'm editing, I don't have a page limit. I just, this is my hours to work and I do whatever I can during those hours. 2020, obviously we homeschooled for quite a long time. So I got back in the routine, which I had done previously, which is I'd get up at 4 a.m. and that would be my work time. And then I'd homeschool for the day, do a bit more when I knocked off. But I basically just give myself set hours and then I've just got to work. And I've been very lucky. I've never really had writer's block. But that said, I do the thing where you just vomit words onto the page and then I figure I can fix them later.
Clean
so
it
I think
up.
That helps. That helps with writer's block. You don't put too much pressure on yourself.
Yeah. Oh, well done. I haven't done, no, I have written some words, but just so very few in lockdown. But anyway.
I think anything, any words, like a page, I think during this year is an achievement.
Yeah. So. So let's go to the cover of this book. It is nothing short of magical. The illustration is by Rachel Tribou or Tribout. Which one is it, Kate?
I say Tribou.
Yeah,
because
it feels
French.
Yep.
Yeah. And so I've just been working on the assumption that that's correct.
Yeah. Let's go with that. Sorry, Rachel, if it's not Tribou. So how did this cover come about and were you pee pants excited when you saw it?
Absolutely beyond it. It was one of the greatest miracles that's happened in my writing career. My daughter and I are enormous fans of Rachel's. We got her Captain Blueberry books a few years ago. We even followed, I don't know if you've seen the books, but they're called The Monsters of Tasmania, and it's got different sort of landmarks in Tasmania, but it kind of the hypothesis is that they're not actually, the nut in Stanley isn't actually the nut, it's a monster. And so we actually followed around the trail and, captured all of the monsters. And every time we'd go down to Salamanca Market, we'd look up at the mountain and the mountain's actually a monster. And so we were really enormous fans of hers. And then my editor at UQP just came to me and said, I've met this, I've discovered this lovely illustrator, and she was actually working up in Queensland then, and her name's Rachel Tribou, do you know her? And I just lost it, and I said, whatever you can do, get her please, because I just could not communicate how enormous our sort of creepy fanship of this lady was. So and she's somehow managed to take Wonder out of my brain and put her on with very little communication between me and her. She just put my character on the page, and now when I close my eyes and think of Wonder, I think of her illustration. So it's been a dream.
It's one of my favorites for this year, honestly. It's
astonishing. And people keep saying to me, I love the cover, and I just go, I love the cover too. It's perfect.
It's a writer's dream, is a perfect cover. Well done.
And basically first try they sent me the cover and I went, yep. And then That's they it. Said we're gonna have sparkles too. We're gonna make it sparkle, and I went, yep. The so I'm very flex, excited. Yeah. It's beautiful.
So, Kate, with all the turmoil going on in the world, have you done anything different in order to connect with your readers?
So this is a bit of a tricky question. I was actually very happy to listen to R.A. Spratt on, was it last week's episode? And she was sort of talking about the different ways that she connects with readers and how some things don't work for her and how other things do work for her. And I was actually really happy to hear that. I'm a really big fan of Rachel's as well. And to hear that she has these struggles as well meant a lot to me. I struggle a lot with anxiety and a lot of social anxiety as well. The one thing I really do love doing to promote my books is talking to kids and getting into schools and chatting with them. And there's nothing that makes me happier than having a classroom of, 8-year-old, 12-year-old kids there to talk to. I'm in my element talking to children. I'm not so good with social media and that side of things. I'm a bit of a failure at that. I don't mind Twitter, but the rest I kind of fail at. And I feel like a lot of the time that's not communicating with the kids anyway. It's communicating with the parents, which is incredibly important. They buy the
gatekeepers.
Books. Yeah. And so that's getting the books into the hands of the kids, but I like actually the one-on-one interfacing. So it's been a really tough little while to not be able to do that. I don't think I've done a good job. And obviously I don't want to have another pandemic or hopefully not another lockdown in Tasmania, but I feel like I've brainstormed and thought of a lot more things I would do differently next time. So I think to answer your question, I haven't done much that's been very good, but hopefully I've got some strategies now in place for what I might be able to do next time. And now we're starting to edge into being able to get into schools again in Tassie, because we're doing okay down here, so hopefully, fingers crossed, I'll just be able to get back to doing what I love.
And like, I don't think you're alone in feeling like you failed at it. There's so many we've had quite a few debut authors on the show during lockdown, and it's just so incredibly difficult. So, you got out of bed. I'm saying that's a win.
And I saw what a lot of other authors were doing and all the incredible videos they were doing and spreadsheets they were doing. And I'm not a video, I don't like having my face on things. And I just kind of sat back and watched them in awe and thought, okay, I'll let them take that side of things. I just kept working and hoped that was enough, and hoped that not too much was expected of us during this time. So
of course. So in in visiting schools, have you had any aha moments, perhaps where a reader has connected with your writing so much that it's changed their life and in turn changed yours?
The delightful thing about, I set all of my books in Tasmania, yep. with the exception of my first book, Three Things About Daisy Blue, where the kids were Tasmanian, but they went to Indonesia. But all of the rest of my books are set in Tassie. So basically the most heartening, delightful thing for me is to go out into Tassie schools and have Tasmanian children go, we see ourselves in books.
Yes.
Because I didn't have that a lot growing up. There weren't a lot of books set in places I recognised or, you know, with characters who felt like me. So it's the most beautiful thing to be able to go into schools and have a kid say, did you set this in our school? Is this our school? Or is this person based on me? Do you know someone like me? You'd be surprised how many kids think the various schools in my books are actually their school, because I do kind of base them on local places. The thing that has made the biggest difference in my life is going to my kids' book week last year and seeing all of the kids dressed as Juno Jones and seeing just the pride on my kids' face to be able to go, oh my gosh, my friends like the books that my mum has written. Her little face just broke my heart. So to that's why I do it, to see her be proud of mummy. So I think that's the thing that changed my life the most.
Oh, that's magic. So let's talk about middle grade books that you believe should have a bit more love at this time. Is there an old one or perhaps a new release you'd like to give a shout out to?
I don't want to pick just one because I have so many that I love. I read a lot of middle grade fiction. Part of the reason I love your podcast so much is I find out the new books that I'm going to get my hands on and my local Dimmicks. I just have to shout them out because during the pandemic, basically they delivered books to me every week. I would listen to your podcast or One More Page or one of the other, you know, the one that Sally Rippon does, the Kid Lit Club, and I would just write down a list and then contact Dimmicks and say, please deliver these to me. And they did every week. But some of the more recent ones that I really loved, I love Nat Amor's books. I think that she is exceptional. I think if her latest one isn't on the CBCA shortlist next year, I told her I'd eat my hat, which I'm not keen on doing. So I'm really hoping that that one's on the list. I really love Penny, and I'm going to mispronounce this as well, Penny Tangy or Penny Tangy. Yep. Her latest book is called As Fast As I Can, and that is honestly one of the most moving, beautiful books I've read in a really long time, which I wasn't expecting. I thought it was going to be a sports book, and it was a sports book, but it also made me cry multiple times. There's a writer called Asphyxia who has a YA book coming out soon. I've got it pre-ordered. But her Grimstones book is one of my favourite middle grade books ever. I've got the omnibus. I think you can buy them separately as well. A.L. Tate, I'm a huge fan of her books. And my kid, actually, I met her at the Squibby conference last year, I think. And my kid saw the photos and she said, Mom, does this mean you're famous now? Because you know A.L. Tate. And I said, I'll take that one. She was excited. I've got two more. Three more maybe. Can I have three more?
You can have as many as you like.
I'm sorry. I find it very hard to limit to one. I really love Rebecca Lim's books. I think she's an incredible own voices writer who writes amazing stuff in that space. Deborah Kelly's The Thing About Oliver, which is on the CBCA shortlist, broke my heart. It's beautiful. And also Cecily Patterson's Kangaroo Valley series. She's got three of them. I think the latest one is something to do with Lola. They're beautiful books. And also I was thinking about an older one that doesn't get as much recognition as it should. And there's a writer called Ben Chandler who wrote a beautiful series. I think they started with Quillblade, but I don't know if they're the Quillblade series. His books don't get talked about enough and they're really incredible, steampunky, sort of really crunchy books, which I think boys will love.
You had me at steampunk.
Oh, he's phenomenal. You need to look up his books.
I will be. Well, what is next in the wings for Kate Gordon? What books have you got coming up?
I've got a couple of things happening. At the moment, I'm working on editing the second book in the Die Leaf Hall series. So I'm working with my editors on that and also drafting book three. So it's going to be a trilogy and I'm working on book three at the moment. I've also got a book out with I've got another Juno Jones book coming out very soon, and I've got another book coming out with Yellow Brick Books, which is called Asta's Good Right Things, which yes. is another middle grade book. But mostly right now my head is very firmly in Die Leaf Hall because I'm editing one and writing one at the moment. Yep. And I've got my first fantasy book coming out next year as well with Wombat Books. So that's a big thing for me because I'm a big fantasy fan and never quite yep. thought I was clever enough to write one. So I'm excited Aww. To have that one out too.
Busy beaver. Well done, Kate.
Lots going on.
Oh,
but we are very bad, very bad at publicity, but keep writing.
That's the main thing. So, Kate, what a delight it has been to chat to you. Where can our listeners find you if they're interested in checking out your books?
I do have a very neglected website, which is just www.kategordon.com.au, where I have sort of book news and information. Mostly as regards social media, I'm mostly on Twitter because I find that a friendlier space than some of the others. So I'm actually on that one as Direleaf Hall, which yep. is just Direleafe Hall. So if you look me up there, I am on Facebook, but very sporadically, but mostly if you want to find me, I'm on lurking on Twitter.
Beautiful.
Retweeting other books usually.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again, Kate, for joining us at Middle Grade Mavens. And the Heart Song of Wonder Quinn is available right now. So you know what to do, listeners.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for stopping by Middle Grade Mavens. If you'd like to know more about the Mavens, log on to middlegradepodcast.com. Or to find Julie online, stop by julieandgrassobooks.com. And to find Pamela, stop by www.ueckerman.net.